This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
I'm Kathleen Petty. You're listening to the October 27th podcast edition of The House. There's no quick fix for Afghanistan.
The development of this nation is probably a matter of generations, not a generation. This country was in the Middle Ages in 2001. That does not mean, however, that our military presence, of course, is a matter of a generation or generations.
So is the 10 years General Rick Hillier suggested closer to what NATO and Canada should plan for? We'll ask the Secretary General of NATO. Is the best way to salvage the Senate the threat of extinction? Senator Hugh Siegel thinks so. We'll talk with him. Also, the anger still burns.
Never, never, and never will I ever vote for the Conservatives.
The decision to tax income trusts may be a year old, but the fury still feels very new. Meanwhile, the Liberals' newish leader must feel very old. We will ask one-time Liberal leadership contender whether Stéphane Dion should be watching his back. And a mystery guest must be revealed by you if you want to beat the House. Canada's highest-rated political affairs program, no question, period. NATO Secretary General had his work cut out for him this week. He chaired an informal meeting of NATO defense ministers to talk about primarily Afghanistan. With the Netherlands threatening to pull troops out of the volatile Oruzgan province, Canada debating the future of its involvement in that country, and some nations unwilling to rotate their troops into danger zones, well, what's the Secretary General supposed to do? To find out, we contacted him. Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer is in Brussels. Welcome to the House.
Thank you so much.
Well, the Dutch defense minister said at this week's meeting that, quote, fair risk and burden sharing remain the leading principles of this alliance, end quote. So how confident are you that that is going to happen in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the Dutch defense minister is right. And I think Peter McKay, my friend, the Canadian defense minister, will say exactly the same. I can tell you that I just came back from the Netherlands, where we had a good meeting on Afghanistan, where we discussed our operation, where I also addressed the points of political, financial, military solidarity very strongly, and where in this case we saw some results in nations coming to the assistance of the Dutch. So we saw, I think, a plus in this ministerial meeting as far as solidarity is concerned.
Well, solidarity is fine, but what about boots on the ground and more equipment and heavy lift helicopters and that sort of thing?
We have seen improvements over the past month. If you ask me, are you entirely satisfied and happy, then my answer is no. We have about a 90%, 90 fill of the military requirements, but 90 is not 100. So I'll not rest until we have 100. We have, as you rightly say, a shortage of helicopters, but we have found a way of outsourcing and leasing helicopter capability. But having said that, I want 100% and not 90.
Okay, and why is the last 10% so tough?
Well, that is because the pressure on all the forces of all the NATO and partner nations is increasing every day. If you look at the Afghanistan operation, that is United Nations mandated, led by NATO. If you look at Kosovo in the Western Balkans in Europe, NATO has 16,000 soldiers, and they need to be there certainly for the foreseeable future. Look at the United Nations, look at Lebanon, look at Africa, look at Darfur, look at the European Union, who might have a mission in Chad in Africa. All those peacekeeping operations do need soldiers.
The Telegraph in Britain, Secretary General, is reporting that the UK is preparing to put more troops in anticipation of Canadian and Dutch forces pulling out. Is that a contingency that is being discussed?
No, and I think it's not true either, by the way, because I have no indication that the already very large British force in Helmand province in Afghanistan is going to be increased at short notice. And I think that after the meetings the NATO defense ministers had, I hope that the Dutch defense minister went home in a more positive mood than in which he came, because there were commitments by other allies to come to the assistance of the Dutch.
When you say you hope the Dutch defense minister went home feeling better than when he arrived, the U.S. defense secretary seemed to be pointing the finger when he arrived, pointing out the alliance has over 2 million soldiers, sailors, marines, and airmen, and wondered why a modest increase is so difficult. But he seemed to leave feeling somewhat satisfied. How would you assess how Robert Gates left the meeting?
Well, I think if I try to read his mind, in the same spirit as I left the meeting, and that is with a plus, in the sense that my expectation level when I went to the Netherlands before that meeting was relatively modest and moderate. I think we were able to end the meeting in the plus, but I side with the Secretary Gates that we have a large pool of forces, but we should increase the usability and the deployability, as we call it, of those forces, because many of those forces are not deployable and not usable.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about deployability, are you talking about troop rotation? Because I know you've also spoken about wanting to see more nations be more willing to rotate to different parts of the country, which would ease the pressure on countries like Canada, who many argue have been doing the heavy lifting in the south.
If I talk about deployability, I first of all call on nations to make their armed forces what we call in our jargon expeditionary, which basically means that you can transport them over long distances and they can sustain operations like in Afghanistan. Secondly, indeed, it is true that I do think that when I talk about solidarity in the alliance, that also means that not a few nations exclusively do the heavy lifting. On the other hand, I have to be a realist, Kathleen, because there are also in other nations, like in Canada, there are parliaments who have a strong say in what forces can do and what they can't do. I cannot do anything else at the end of the day than accept that for the moment and continuing my plea that these caveats, as we call them, these limitations on the use of forces, will be lifted. And let me once say from my comfortable position here behind the microphone in Brussels that I pay great respect to all those men and women in uniform on the ground in Afghanistan who do this tremendously complicated job for us, and many of them have paid the highest price.
Secretary General, our Chief of Defense Staff was in Afghanistan this week, and he said there it will be a decade before Afghan troops can stand up on their own. You've talked about a commitment for a generation. Can you give me a sense of what kind of timeline we're realistically looking at?
That's difficult. I understand Rick Hillier's comments. He's an old Afghanistan hand, as we all know, because he was an A1 commander of the ISF forces not that long ago. I'm a bit hesitant to give timelines here. What I've said and what I can repeat is that the development of this nation is probably a matter of generations, not a generation. This country was in the Middle Ages in 2001. That does not mean, however, that our military presence, of course, is a matter of a generation or generations. What we have to do, and there we are, I think, not doing enough, and that is that we should do much more in training the Afghan National Army, and much more should be done in training the Afghan police. Training are my three key words in this regard. But timelines, dates and years, I think it's very difficult.
Well, going back to where I started, this idea of fair risk and burden sharing, at one point do you believe that Afghan troops will be able to do that?
Well, difficult to say. As I said, let me repeat, we are there for the long haul. Let's not forget what underpins this mission, Kathleen. That is, first of all, protecting people from brutality and knowing the Canadian tradition of protecting people from brutality. Thousands of Canadians are resting in their graves in my home country, the Netherlands, and we respect them until this very day for that. The second element is we are building a nation in Afghanistan under the full mandate of the United Nations. And point number three, also important, is that Afghanistan, unfortunately, is one of the front lines in our fight against terrorism. And there, the Dutch or the Belgians or the British or the Canadian people should realize that security in Afghanistan is directly linked to their security.
Secretary General, finally, to what extent is NATO's credibility and long-term viability, some suggest, tied to success in Afghanistan?
It's very important for NATO because in the future I see that NATO and NATO forces will be called upon more frequently instead of less frequently to lead and conduct crisis response or peacekeeping operations. So Afghanistan is very important for NATO, very important indeed. And we must show that we as NATO, all the NATO allies, can run a credible mission in Afghanistan.
Secretary General, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And Jaap Hoogscheffer is the NATO Secretary General. He spoke with me from NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. And a senior member of the ruling party in the Netherlands told reporters this week he expects the Dutch to extend their mission past the August 2008 deadline. Well, it's that time again. Time to exercise the trivia corner of your brain. Time to try and beat the house. Last week, we challenged you with this question.
Hello, my name is Diana Blatzy. I am the Member of Parliament for Calgary Nose Hill and the Secretary of State for Small Business and Tourism. Last week, I asked you to name the report that the Canadian Federation of Independent Business wrote based on a survey it conducted of its members regarding the paperwork burden. The answer is, the report is called Rated R, Prosperity Restricted by Red Tape.
I know what you're thinking. Who knew the paperwork burden was such a racy topic? Well, 24 of you knew the right answer. One of you wrote to tell us that you even had to do an analytical review of that report. Our two winners this week are Chris Budlong of Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Larry Kahn of Burnaby, BC. Now, before we go to this week's question, I thought we should give you a little heads up. We're mixing things up a little bit. This week, we have a mystery guest whose identity you have to guess. He'll give you three clues, and hopefully, you won't get the answer too easily. So, here we go.
Hi, I'm this week's mystery guest on Beat the House. What is my name and what do I do? Here are my three clues. My new boss has a famous dog. I'm a proud Quebecer and a former Montrealer. I was president of the youth wing of Canada's longest-serving political party. What is my name, and what do I do?
And as usual, we will announce two winners on next week's show. And please get your answers in by Sunday at midnight, and the winners will have their choice of a house tote bag or a house t-shirt. So email your answers to thehouse@cbc.ca, and in the subject line write, Beat the House. Or you can call in your answers to 1-866-664-0638. Again, email your answers to thehouse@cbc.ca and in the subject line write Beat the House, or call in your answer to 1-866-664-0638, and we'll announce the winners on next week's show. Well, let's take a moment to cast our minds back to Montreal's Palais de Congrès last December, a packed convention hall, a sea of green banners, and a federal Liberal Party toasting their newly minted leader, Stéphane Dion. Yeah, well, that was then. This is now. Less than a year into his tenure as Liberal Party leader, it seems Stéphane Dion has to defend his leadership at every turn. And Sheila Copps thinks she knows why. She's a former Deputy Prime Minister and former Liberal leadership candidate, and she joins me in studio. Sheila Copps, welcome to the House.
Thank you.
So a lot of rumors about people plotting to, I don't know, bring Stéphane Dion down, for lack of a better description. Are the rumors real?
Well, I think there's a group of people, in particular out of Montreal, who were very dissatisfied when he won the leadership in the first place, and it kind of divides on sort of constitutional lines. There was a big debate going into the leadership about Quebec's status as a nation, and there was a resolution in the party that was a part of the whole discussion, and some of the people at the convention were unhappy that Stéphane Dion won because he has such a strong perspective on the clarity of a country splitting up. And I think those people have never really given up. And obviously, when you're the leader of the opposition and you have some organizational problems and other problems, sometimes your enemies will pile in on you. And that's what's happening here in a fairly organized fashion. But at this point, it's restricted to one part of the country.
When you say in a fairly organized fashion, what do you mean?
When you see a whole slew of people dropping out at the same time, announcing their quitting, all kind of tied into the same week and leading up to the throne speech. It was pretty obvious that it wasn't just sort of one random person, but it was organized.
How is it possible, though, for even something that's organized to have this kind of impact? I mean, it seems to me it has to say something about the party itself, that it would be vulnerable in this
way. I think in most instances, opposition parties are vulnerable and governments are not, because when you're in government, the prime minister and the prime minister's entourage have levers of discipline that aren't available to the opposition leader. So historically, opposition leaders have always had a problem. And I mean, it's kind of ironic when I see people saying, never has this happened in the Liberal Party. Well, I lived through the Meech debate, which was extremely divisive internally, and also, of course, at that time, Mr. Turner was the leader, and he had to go through a review process. And when Mr. Chrétien won the leadership in 90 and then started, and there were some people who weren't too happy about that, that was quelled after the election, because when you become a government, as Mr. Harper's found, when he was in opposition, people said, he's gone, he's disappeared, nobody ever sees him. Now, meanwhile, he was laying the groundwork for his own organization. And I think the leader of the opposition faces that. So if you take that, coupled with the fact that Stéphane Dion was everybody's second choice, if you can think about it that way, at the convention, there were two big blocks going into the convention. One of them was Ignatieff and one was Bob Rae. Dion was positioned to kind of be the compromise candidate. And there are certainly some people who were pretty convinced that their candidate was going to win because they were so far ahead. And they've been disappointed that the guy who was third man up ended up winning and haven't reconciled themselves to it. I mean, when you see somebody like a Denis Coderre refusing the leader's offer to become the Quebec lieutenant, obviously Mr. Coderre has very close contact with Mr. Ignatieff, and that's something that Mr. Ignatieff could have convinced him to take on in the interests, the higher interest of the party. So did he do it on his own? Probably, but at the same time, the moral suasion from the leader of your group in the caucus can also be strong if the leader chooses to exercise it. Mr. Dion has been under attack almost from the day that he got there, coupled with the fact that obviously his own organizational problems and some of his linguistic
challenges
have made him a hard sell.
And his skill as a politician.
Yeah, I mean, his background, obviously, he's brilliant on the policy side and he's a great thinker. His hands-on people skills aren't as strong. But there's another guy kind of in the same situation by the name of Stephen Harper. So when people say, oh, well, this, that, and I said, you know.
But does he also need to take a tougher line with people who might be working against him? I think even to what Jean Chrétien wrote in his recent
memoirs,
book,
yeah.
Sort of essentially saying, you know, I let it go on for too long. He was talking about Paul Martin. Is it possible that that's
Stéphane Dion
needs to do?
I think what he's got to do is he's got to bring together Mr. Ignatieff, Mr. Rae, Mr. Kennedy, the other candidates, and kind of say, look, let's sit down and maybe have a one-on-one amongst the leadership of the party to say, look, can we move forward on this? It definitely, he needs a strategy and he needs one quickly. And I think he started, but you can expect that it's not going to end and there will be some more internal party shenanigans before the end of the year. And there are some people who are literally poised to try and force him out before an election.
Like?
A lot of the people that signed the letter, there was a letter circulating at the Liberal Convention kind of saying that Stéphane Dion will never be elected in Quebec. And there were a whole slew of signatories to that letter who also happened to match up to this kind of internal boil, as it were, in the party.
So he needs to lance it.
Oh, he definitely needs to lance it. But I do think that if he can manage to bring those naysayers on board, then at least give Mr. Dion a chance to have an election and then let the people have a say, because the parties had a say and they did choose Stéphane Dion, whether other leadership candidates like it or not.
We'll leave it there. Good to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Great to talk to you.
Sheila Copps is a former deputy prime minister and former Liberal leadership candidate. Now, while Mr. Dion is busy protecting his back from his party, the government is trying to force the Liberals into an election. And our comedy crew in Winnipeg refused to be whipped into abstention.
Mr. Speaker, now that the throne speech has passed, due to the Liberal Party's abstention, we would like to get on with the business of governing. Accordingly, We are introducing a bill to cut the GST not by an additional 1%, but down to 1%.
Chair recognizes Mr. Layden.
Mr. Speaker, this Tory plan would leave nothing for social spending. The government is clearly trying to provoke an election. Well, the NDP isn't afraid to give it to them. We will vote against this bill.
Mr. Dion.
It is an outrageous and reckless measure, one that we, the official opposition, will not oppose, officially.
Oh, come on, Dion.
Canadians don't want an election, especially Liberal Canadians. We will abstain.
Shame. All right, how about this? Be it resolved that the Canadian mission in Afghanistan be extended into 2015.
Okay.
For crying out loud.
Extended into Pakistan.
What's the worst that could happen?
Extended into France. We want to send troops into France.
The chair recognizes Mr. Duceppe.
Mr. Dion, I urge you to vote with the Bloc and the NDP to stop this madness.
We Liberals believe we can express our position more strongly by sitting quietly and saying nothing.
Okay, Mr. Speaker, whereas this government has already rejected the Kyoto Protocol, and whereas Mr. Dion's pet dog is named Kyoto, be it resolved that Mr. Dion's dog be renamed Intensity-Based Target.
Hey.
I want to hear from Mr. Dion.
Intensity-Based. Nice name.
Oh, for crying out loud. Okay, how about be it resolved that Pig Latin will become Canada's third official language? What does the opposition leader have to say to that?
Is this a confidence motion?
Yes.
I have say, hey, o ne, o blempre, ithwe, ate.
What?
I abstain, ye.
Hear he, hear he.
Stand up and vote.
Beyond how long are you going to let me walk all over you?
I love that kind of massage.
Hear he, hear he.
What do I have to do?
As broken promises go, this one was a whopper. The federal finance minister, Jim Flaherty, said last year the government would tax income trusts. This after campaigning in 2006 against doing exactly that. The government argued that corporate giants like BCE and TELUS would convert to trust status and cost the federal treasury billions, since profits would be passed along to investors and not taxed in the hands of the corporation. Instead, the government decision cost investors billions. The value of the trust plummeted by an estimated $35 billion. A year later, investors are still furious. They plan a protest on Parliament Hill next week. And this week, our reporter Louise Elliott sat down with some of them. Good morning.
Good morning, Kathleen.
So who did you meet with?
Well, Kathleen, I met with a group of investors over a coffee in an Ottawa restaurant. Some of these people drove from as far away as Quebec City and Cornwall, Ontario, to talk about this issue.
That's a long way for a coffee.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. I mean, what struck me was how angry and betrayed these people are feeling still 1 year later, 1 year after this decision. I talked to four men, three of whom are retirees in their 60s and 70s. One of the retirees, David Marshall, is actually organizing next week's rally. Don Francis is a retired scientist, and Jean-Marie Lapointe is a retiree from Quebec. And the last person, John Yarbrough, is actually an American who moved here 5 years ago when he married a Canadian woman. He says he's so angry that he's actually joined the Liberal Party, even though he's a Republican in his native country.
Okay, well, you've certainly piqued my interest, so let's have a listen to the conversation.
You mentioned that you might change your voting pattern as a result of this type of experience. Is that true, or is that just potential?
Never, never, and never will I ever vote for the Conservatives. You hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I've taken time to write to every Conservatives MP in Quebec, receive zero reply, zero and nothing at all. I was managing the registered education savings plan, and overnight, in one single night, all registered education plans went down.
Is this for your grandchildren? Or?
Yeah, my grandchildren.
Okay.
Went down 25%. It means that since 98, I've lost everything, every grant I have received.
How many grandchildren do you have?
Three.
What have you done to try to fix that? Is there
anything? Nothing to this day. I can't believe that this is the Canada I live in. And it is, if I conclude that it is the Canada I live in, I will be a Bloc Québécois and a separatist forever, and I will work day and night to get out of this country.
David, you were talking earlier about you're organizing this rally on Wednesday, and I'm wondering, what are you hearing from the people who are traveling to it? What is their story? What kinds of stories are you hearing?
What I'm hearing basically is, what am I going to do now since the income trust sector may be eliminated? Where am I going to get my income to pay my bills? That's basically the concern why everybody is here. Now, also, a lot of people are concerned about the fibbing. They're not happy with it. They feel that Harper basically bought their vote because he promised never to tax the income trusts. And yet, 6 months later, he turned around and did just the opposite. So they're not happy with that. When you go to vote now, you don't really know how to determine the candidate that you want to vote for, because the fibbing is on such a high level today that it's so bad that these guys just open their mouth and you know they're lying.
Tell me about there's a woman coming this week who called you. Tell me a little bit about her story.
Yeah, a nice lady. She told me she's 87 years old, from Mississauga. She's going to travel by herself from Toronto. And the question she asked me is, directly asking me, what am I going to do now to pay my bills? I didn't know what to tell her. The bills that people have every day are, you know, increasing all the time. So when you go to retire and you're working, say, at 50, 55 years of age, you naturally are determining, okay, this is how much I need. And you say, okay, I'll have some income trusts in here and things like this. But what happened now, there may not be any income trusts. So now the question is, how am I going to pay my bills?
Donald, tell me a bit about your story here. Were you heavily invested in these trusts, and what have you done in the intervening years since they were taxed?
Well, I was, Louise, but I've now passed on from that. I think this isn't a human interest story. This is really a story about our country being given away by corrupt and evil politicians. You've heard from my two colleagues here about other, some more specific seniors things. I'm far more concerned about my children and my grandchildren. I may run out of money before I die, and I guess they're going to have to support me, because I know Harper and his boys won't, and I don't think Canada will be able to by the time I get old enough. Into my 80s or my 90s, I don't think this country's going to be able to afford anything.
It sounds like this trust and confidence issue is the deepest issue. I mean, the money is an issue, obviously. Anyone who loses money, I've lost money in my investments. Right. Everyone's lost money all the time.
Risk.
But really, it sounds like for you, the issue is one of trust in the politicians who may make or break their word.
Well, I'm fairly new to this country. I've only been here 5 years. I'm an American who, my wife's Canadian. But really, the thing that got me was, I came across as what you call a Republican, Reagan Republican. And so when the conservatives made these promises, I thought they were the same conservatives as what I was used to. And then when they pulled their lies, I was just utterly shocked, stunned, just speechless. I convinced my father-in-law, who was a 50-year liberal, to vote for the conservatives. And then I had to go back and say, I was wrong. Because I trusted these guys, because they're supposed to be conservatives. They're not conservatives. I don't know what they are. They're bribing Quebec with $900 million of our tax money to get votes. I mean, what is this? I've now joined the Liberal Party. I'm going to go get my citizenship so I can vote in the next election, so that I can vote against these conservatives. Well, I shouldn't call conservatives these people.
So what are you going to do now? Like, what, have you made a change already, or are you waiting?
I shifted some things around, do a little tax loss selling. Again, I haven't really left the field. I talked to a few people. I think the main thing I'm hearing through the grapevine is there will be changes coming, amendments to it, because this legislation, and this is a quote, this legislation, and this is coming from CRA to the Income Trust. So Canada Revenue has said, we don't know what to do. we don't know how to do these conversions, so there's going to have to be changes because this legislation is so poorly written.
So you're shaking your head. Are you skeptical that there will be changes, Jean-Marie?
No, I agree with my friend John.
Okay.
I agree that it's such a nonsense, it can't survive. Mm-hmm. It's total stupidity. We lose the income, we lose the taxes, we lose the resources. We're left behind as retirees, as small investors, as Canadians, and as taxpayers. You, all Canadian listening, you will pay the bill.
That's $7.5 billion.
You will pay the bill.
Tell me a bit, I just want to ask you fellows, about this sense of betrayal, because John is talking about a complete shock when this promise was broken. Did you have a similar feeling, David? What was your feeling when this happened?
I was basically kind of numb. I didn't really understand what it all meant. It took a while for it to sort of sink in.
But you knew that they were going back on a promise.
Definitely.
Anybody who can actually has ears knows that.
Yeah.
And if they didn't know it then,
they
know it now.
With the promise that he made, that he didn't have to really smash the income trust after. You know, there were other avenues that they could have done, and this was brought out through recommendations that were made by the House of Commons Finance Committee back in February,
I think it was.
Yes. And they had certain recommendations that I think that all of us here are prepared to live with.
And I have to admit, I thought, well, boy, that's a refreshing promise, you know. And even though I'm forever now suspicious of neocon conservative promises, I'm also suspicious of NDP promises and Liberal promises and Bloc Québécois promises for various reasons. I was not surprised, but I was certainly hurt by the fact that he broke a promise. And to me, that's the real key. And for some reason, there's no ethics. There's no shame if you tell a lie. Where's the shame? I cannot understand how these guys can sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. What do we make of the Liberal proposal? I think it actually came out of that finance committee you were talking about, to reduce the taxation level at the very least to, I think, 10%. What do we think of that idea?
And refund to Canadians that tax when it's paid. So we lend it to them, they give it back. Now, it wasn't going to refund the 10% to foreign owners, which at least gives us control over society. Now what they've done is they flipped that around. Now, if you're a foreign guy and you come in and buy a trust as a leveraged buyout, you don't pay 10%. You don't pay 15%. You know what you pay? Nothing.
Zero.
Nothing. And then they turned around and stopped Canadian companies from doing the same thing.
Would you have invested differently if this promise had not been made?
I would not. I would have been much more cautious. Mr. Harper came along with his grandiose promise that, you know, seniors need these. And he's even quoted as saying these seniors need income trust to survive. I mean, I would have been much more cautious if he had never made the promise. I will be doing everything in my power to get everybody I know to vote against the Conservatives. And by the way, I even put a Conservative sign in my yard the last election. A Liberal sign will be going in my yard this time. That's for sure.
You can hear more of Louise Elliott's conversation with Income Trust investors if you go to our website at cbc.ca/thehouse and just click on audio. And if you'd like to send us an email at thehouse@cbc.ca, we'd love to hear your comments because they're always welcome in our house. Speaking of which, we'd like to share with you some of the letters we've received over the past few weeks. And our producer, Amy Castle, has been compiling them and she's brought some with her. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Kathleen.
Well, last week you and I went over to the House of Commons to meet with three House leaders. The discussion between Peter Van Loan, Ralph Goodale, and Libby Davies was, how can I put this delicately, spirited. And that interview prompted some spirited response from our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Including this email from Brent DeVos of Lethbridge, Alberta. As I was listening to the three House leaders sparring on the show today, I kept thinking, what would these people sound like if a buzzer sounded every time they used an adverb like clearly, actually, absolutely, or completely, or one of those tired, meaningless phrases like in reality, or the fact is, or the truth is, or that proverbial favorite, it is very clear that. I can't help but wonder, if you were to take away those rhetorical crutches, would their discourses stumble and fall, or would they be sustained with ideas of substance?
Well, Amy, Elizabeth Royshar said this: our MPs have had 180-plus days off to come up with something positive for our country, for the homeless, for the less fortunate among us, the environment, etc. And all your guests could come up with was pure drivel, one-upmanship, attacks on other member MPs. Zirk Mercer says, how about getting back to work? This is what we out here have to do to keep these people in Ottawa. Shame on them.
Kathleen, last week you talked to two pollsters to get their read on how well the throne speech tapped into issues on the minds of Canadians. Barb Derrick didn't think much of what they had to say. She wrote, the pollsters, economic gurus, and government are so off the mark of what people are concerned about. The issues are poverty, homelessness, wages, the working poor, food banks. Why are all these issues not front and center? I find most people are so removed from the real life of most Canadians.
And Amy, 2 weeks ago, we featured a report by Louise Elliott regarding the influence of the farm vote. And after that item, we heard from John Solos of Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, who told us this. Farmers hold a disproportionate amount of power. To me, this is good news at last. Farmers feed us, and our local farmers are likely to assume increasing importance in future in this regard. We better start looking after them better.
And finally, you may recall the discussion 2 weeks ago with Foreign Affairs critics Bob Ray and Paul Dewar. They were responding to the government's plan to create an expert panel to look into Canada's involvement in Afghanistan. Wallace Shuchuk said this, today's guests normally whine and snivel that the government ignores everyone else's wishes. Today, you had them whining and sniveling that the government is abrogating its responsibility by asking for everyone else's opinion on what to do in Afghanistan after 2009. Isn't politics fun?
I think it depends on who you are. We do enjoy hearing your thoughts on the stories on the show. You can send us an email at thehouse@cbc.ca.
Or you can phone in a message to 1-866-664-0638.
Thanks, Amy.
My pleasure.
Well, you don't often get to quote Mick Jagger and the Boys on a program about politics, but somehow the lyric, you can't always get what you want, seems appropriate here.
This party's preference has always been to see a reformed and elected Senate, but if the Senate can't be reformed, the only other alternative would be to abolish it.
Those remarks were made by Stephen Harper last week, and if that wasn't enough, now a Canadian senator is adding his two cents on the future of the Senate. This week, Senator Hugh Siegel put forward a motion that Canada hold a referendum to consider whether the Senate should live or die. And he joins me in studio. Senator Siegel, welcome to the House.
Great to be here.
So do you think the Prime Minister thinks you're being awfully helpful?
I doubt it. I think he really is more committed, quite frankly, to reform. I think he'd like to see term limits, which is the bill he tried to get through the Senate. We all tried to help him, to no avail. And he'd like to see an electoral process where people actually get to pick the persons that he, in the end, appoints, so that we had something a bit more democratic. So, I don't think abolition is his first choice. But he has said, I think he said when he appeared before the Senate committee last year, that if there isn't a consensus on reform, there may be a consensus on abolition. We have some premiers already, the premier of BC and Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Ontario have said they would prefer abolition to the reforms that our government has proposed, which mm-hmm. is fair enough. There's been a democratic murmur about a place that's not democratic, suggesting abolition.
A murmur?
Well, I think Canadians from time to time, you'll see it'll be a particular event that transpires in the Senate about a bill or an issue, and people will say, what's this undemocratic place making these decisions for us anyway?
Right.
What's that all about? And, you know, it was the British government did a white paper on Lords reform for the House of Lords, and they are the ones who said that this is the most powerful second chamber in the world, because even the United States Senate, which is elected and very powerful, can be vetoed by the President of the United States or by the U.S. Congress. In the British system, they have something called the Powers of Parliament Act, 1926, which says that in any shootout between the Senate and their House of Commons, or the Lords and their House of Commons wins because it's democratically elected. But we don't have any of those protections here. And I think with the lack of progress on reform, premiers who want abolition, Maybe we should clear the air, stand back and say, let's give the people a chance to express their view, because after all, we all work for them.
The strategy is interesting, though, because, you know, I can't help but think about Mark Antony. I'm here to bury Caesar, not to praise him. So a referendum to bury the Senate is an effort to save it?
Well, I don't know that, but it'd be interesting to see how the vote goes if we get, you know, a strong view across the country plus a view in each province that is a majority for abolition. I think first ministers would be hard-pressed.
What would be the odds of a majority for abolition, though?
My sense would be pretty high.
Really?
Yeah, I think it would differ by region. I think the Atlantic region, because they have quite a large Senate representation for their relatively small population, would probably be very much for preserving the Senate. I think they see it more importantly. I think in places like British Columbia, who are massively underrepresented, and Ontario, massively underrepresented, there might be a vote.
Quebec?
Well, Quebec is interesting. Quebec has always viewed the Senate as one of its guarantees on a host of issues. And the Quebec government was the government that wrote the letter with respect to the reform efforts last year, saying we think they should go to the Supreme Court and there should be consultation first. And I think Quebec has had a position that their senator shouldn't be elected, nor appointed by the prime minister, but they would prefer that it be appointed by the Assemblée nationale. So Quebec would be probably a tougher to call, to be fair, in terms of the outcome. But I'd like to think that we could as a country survive a democratic debate. And let's see what the people say.
But the risk here is that you don't get 50% plus one in favor of abolition. I mean, the risk for someone who is promoting the view that you're promoting, and then there's no incentive to reform. And then you've got a bunch of senators who don't feel compelled at all to reform.
Well, no, let me put the contrary proposition to you. Just think about the referendum in Quebec on separation. There was the yes side for separation and the no side. What did the no side say? The no side said, vote no, vote for Canada, and we will work to change the Constitution. And that produced constitutional negotiations, Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a host of different things. The no side here is not going to say, please support the Senate as it is. Unrepresentative, unelected, not enough people from the West, that's good, just keep it that. They're not going to say that. The no side's going to say, vote to keep the Senate and we will change it. We will reform it. We will make it more representative, more democratic. So either way, you'll get either a mandate from the public who says, shut her down. We don't need a second legislature. We can manage with one parliament. Many countries do.
Yeah.
Versus those who will say, keep it and let's make it better. Either way, you'll get a mandate, which I think the politicians in all the political parties will have to listen to. I think the public should be given a chance to give direction to the politicians, not after they've worked something out, but before they work it out, so the public gets to actually say, yes, we do think we want an institution like this, but it has to be changed, or we don't think we need it at all. And if we don't think we need it at all, why go through Cirque du Soleil backflips to reform it?
We're talking about this referendum like it's going to happen, but of course, the motion has to pass. And does it have a snowball's chance in you know where?
Well, as I look across the aisle at my liberal majority there, who are, you know, they outnumber us 3-1 on the Tory side, I sense the support is sparse. The word that comes to mind is sparse. And on my own side, I'd be fair, I think there's some people who aren't 100% sure it's the best way to proceed. But I intend to make the case. I have Senator Murray, a very, very thoughtful, longtime senator, very much in support of this. He'll be speaking to it. I know of some others who will on the other side as well. So we're going to make the case on merits, not on the blue versus red or Tory, but on the merits that democracy every 140 years isn't a radical shift. It is a good thing to do. I have a high regard for the Senate. I think they do great work, Kirby on mental health, outstanding work, defense, etc. But doing good work doesn't mean legitimacy. You know, there are all kinds of bright young people who worked in the Kremlin Economics Department, except they weren't elected by anybody. That didn't mean they were legitimate. They did great work. They worked hard. They believed in Mother Russia. They were there to serve. We have to separate out those questions because legitimacy is important in a democracy, and the Senate can't be outside the range of legitimacy.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure, Kathleen.
Senator Hugh Siegel joined me in our Ottawa studio. Senator Siegel says he would like to hear from the people. So, you're the people. What do you think of his proposal? Send us an email at thehouse@cbc.ca or leave us a message at 1-866-664-0638. And now for a little house cleaning. The North Star, beacon of freedom for escaped slaves, mid-ocean guide for lost mariners. Is it the rhetorical reef upon which the Conservative Party will be dashed?
It helps navigators that are faced with turbulent waters, with a variety of choices, confusing routes, to always come back to that North Star, that navigational beacon, and ensure that you're always ultimately headed in the right direction.
Oh, for the love of God, somebody buy the minister a literary compass. The celestial body that guides his government's oratory has led his tongue astray. And a new government bill introduced Friday will ensure that the few people who cover their faces while voting will now have to uncover to cast a ballot. Meanwhile, there are other problems with the act.
Mr. Speaker, changes to the Canada Election Act have resulted in more than 1 million rural Canadians losing the right to vote in the next election.
It turns out if your mailing address is a post office box, all 1 million plus of you have effectively had a paper bag put over your head. And finally, hey, who's that guy sitting in the finance minister's seat the other day? John McCallum was having some trouble figuring it out.
Did the Dark Lord Voldemort sitting on his throne in the PMO order his finance underling to do it?
Okay, so he has some minion of an evil fictional character. What was he doing in the House of Commons?
He must have got a grade of F at Finance Wizard School.
Really, is that where you send students who flunk out of the Magic Academy? Are you sure it wasn't a case of mistaken identity?
I'm at best a mere elf.
Well, there you have it from the honorable member from Whitby, Oshawa. He's no bad boy failure. He's one of Santa's little helpers. And that's your house cleaning. And that's the program. If you love politics, you'll want to tune in to News World weekdays at 5 o'clock Eastern to watch my colleague, Don Newman. And we always want to know what you have to say about our program, so write to us. The email address is thehouse@cbc.ca. On today's show, we would like to thank Georges de Bruyers and the NATO technical staff in Brussels, Belgium, Alison Crawford in Ottawa, and Daniel Gervais, Mike O'Brien, Doug Holmes, Chris Reed, and Joff Schmidt, the Comedy Boys Club in Winnipeg. And our crew this week has been producer Amy Castle, associate producer technician Paul McGinnis, and our senior producer is Max Paris. I'm Kathleen Petty. Have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.